Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And today's guest is Brad Byram, who was a longtime participant in the Zen Hospice community of San Francisco.
Yes.
Because I'm guessing there are Zen Hospice communities all over the world, right? So let's specify.
Well, there are certainly Zen communities all over the world and hospice communities. But Zen Hospice is
they don't always.
Unique.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They don't always intersect. All right. You've been for 18 years.
Yeah.
And since we've just met, but I did learn about you that you write poetry, which got me. So let's just talk about you for a start and talk about you.
Wow,
talk about me. And I know we've only got 30 minutes, but talk about how did you come to write poetry and what did you do before Zen Hospice? And if you're comfortable, how did you get involved?
Oh, well, great questions. How did I come to write poetry? Poetry has been a part of my life, I think, for a very long time.
Since you were a boy?
Yeah, I can remember my grandmother reading poetry to me when I was a little boy. And of course, the poetry that I read then was the old 19th century American poets, most of which I can't remember at this point.
But they weren't necessarily children's poets, like Eugene Field or something.
Poets, uh-huh. No. I remember Rudyard Kipling, of course, right? This was apparently a favorite poet for young men.
Oh, nice. Okay.
In the mid-20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But my real connection with poetry didn't come until later in my life. It actually came as part of my spiritual journey.
Okay. You want to just kind of give us a hint?
Well, I think I began moving in a poetic direction, both in terms of my own sensibility and in my writing and creativity about 20 years ago, and it was in the context of initially writing in journals about spiritual experience and realizing that language is so inadequate to capture the depths of what we experience in our lives.
That's why we have music.
That's exactly right. And so that, and poetry for me is musical.
It is.
Right.
So yes.
It created this a way for me to express the inexpressible. And so that's really what brought me to poetry in my adult life as a creative expression of my own experience.
We were talking about, I had mentioned that I'm kind of sorry to see rhyme has disappeared. And you said, which I agree with 100%, that's because we don't hear it read out loud.
Right.
And I really do think poetry is to be shared. There's a rhythm to it that's critical.
Absolutely.
And if you get to an end of a line and you haven't read it in the right way, you're stuck with an extra two beats and it's a terrible feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, learning, again, from my own sense of poetic expression, that the silence within the poem
is as
important as the voice of the poem.
Yes.
And how the poem moves from expression to silence and back again.
Yes, that's like the empty page on the paper for a drawing. It's part of the... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so really important. And so that's my own sense of moving into poetic expression.
And how did you get involved with Zen Hospice?
Well, that began about... Actually, it began years ago.
Okay, may I ask first, what did you do for work before Zen Hospice?
Well, the last 12 years or so, I've been working in the corporate world
as
a business development person. Prior to that, I was in the nonprofit world for quite a long time. And, so I've moved back and forth between the for-profit and the profit world. And partially that's just about making a living.
Yes, well, you have to do that. Tell me, let's define what hospice is for people who may not know.
Well, the basic definition of hospice is a period of time at the end of one's life when one makes a turn from seeking curative medical help to palliative help, where one is actually looking to bring closure to one's life in a place where there is no longer the possibility of cure.
And it means that you stop taking medications...
No, you what, make, that you mean? It used to mean to take that. Medication.
Uh-huh.
So the focus shifts. Focus shifts to comfort. So at the end of life, what we discover, at least what I've discovered working with people at the end of life, is that what we want is to find a way to be as fully present as we can with as little pain or discomfort as we can, so that we can engage with those we love in ways that can bring closure to a life.
And does, do you pay attention to giving people permission to let go of life, as opposed to when sometimes when people are in medical care, they're told, you know, you can beat this, and it's up to you, and you can. When does that shift, that people get permission?
Great question. Sometimes it never shifts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
that's not a particular part of hospice, or
well, by definition, when people come to hospice, there has been a shift.
Oh,
many
yes,
people
of course.
Don't come to hospice at all at the end of their life.
Sure.
So when I
didn't think of that.
But when they come to hospice, there has been a shift already. That doesn't mean that the person who's in hospice is accepting of necessarily of what's unfolding for them. The thing about letting go and acceptance is what you discover is that what you can accept today might not be able to accept tomorrow.
Oh, and, good point.
Right?
Yes.
So it's an iterative process of letting go. It's not something that happens once for all.
Mm-hmm.
It happens progressively through the course of our life in lots of different ways.
Yes.
And at the end of our life. What I do notice is the capacity to open to one's experience and to let go and to be supported in that's really, really important. Part of what hospice is
that's
is
the permission
for
uh-huh.
people
yes.
in that experience so that there is an opening. At Zen Hospice, we talk about creating a space for living at the end of life. And it's in that space that this transformation, and sometimes quite an astonishing transformation, can take place.
I'd like to know about that. I'm wondering, do people sometimes feel guilty for abandoning their loved ones and people who are dependent on them?
Of course, that can come up. Yeah, it can come up. And that's an intense kind of process that people work through, and it's relational. So they're working through relationships, and the strength of those relationships can be critical for making it possible for a person to really be able to let go and to be able to say to someone,
mm-hmm.
I love you, I am so grateful for you, I don't want to leave you. And I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to be able to say goodbye in a way that creates connection and also brings closure.
And I imagine for parents, it's very important. I mean, I feel that it's very important to have your children assure you that they are going to be fine without you.
There is that. There is always that place. So one of the things that happens for people in the process of dying is it can be extremely lonely. And the loneliness comes, we notice in hospice, the loneliness comes because, not intentionally usually, mostly unintentionally, and sometimes unconsciously, people will often subtly withdraw from the person as their life is coming to an end. And that's
it. The person whose life is coming to an end will withdraw.
No,
people withdraw from them.
Yeah.
Oh,
because there's a fear around
the pain. Yes.
Right? There's a fear around the pain. There's often surrounded by people who are doing professional things: doctors, nurses, CNAs, all the wonderful people that support people at the end of life. And there can be a feeling of loneliness for people at the end of life, longing for somebody in their life to just have a conversation with them, like you and I are having this conversation now, looking into each other's eyes and talking about it. And what we notice in creating a space for living at the end of life is if you create spaces to hold those kinds of conversations where people have permission and are supported to express what they're really experiencing, that's where there's the greatest potential for people to deeply connect. And in that connection is the support they need at the end of life.
So your personal focus is on people connecting.
Really is.
By the way, which
connecting.
Is what you do through poetry and
exactly.
other places in your life.
Yeah.
Rather than dying.
Yeah.
Yes. My father explained death to me, I'll be ever grateful, when I was really a very little girl. And he said, you know, sweetheart, he said, people have to die. the old leaves have to make way for the new leaves. And think what a terrible, terrible world this would be if no one died.
Mm.
And that always made sense until it was my old leaf.
Yeah.
You know, then it took a little doing to...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's, you know, that's a common, actually, a very common metaphor that's used by a number of spiritual teachers around the nature of...
What's that?
The metaphor of the tree and the leaf, right? It's a very... fairly common metaphor that I've seen. Thich Nhat Hanh, for instance, uses that
in
one of his teachings, about the fact that we are, each of us, impermanent and living in this impermanence. But the thing about it, Janet, is when it's that very impermanence, that very precariousness, that actually is a deep point of intimacy between us. When we can acknowledge that that's true, it's true of you, it's true of me, it's true in this moment, we've arisen, we will pass away.
Mm-hmm.
When we can connect at that level of our vulnerability and precariousness, that is a powerful moment of really knowing and supporting mm-hmm. each other. And that's what we hope can unfold at Zen Hospice Project as we're working with people at the end
now,
of their lives.
I'm a little confused because I've seen people at home under hospice care. Mm-hmm. These angels come visit.
And, yeah.
Yes. And then I see buildings that say hospice. And so people can either live in a hospice setting or be visited at home?
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. So the hospice, as hospice was originally conceived, it was an alternative to dying in the hospital. So the original hospice model was to support people to die in their homes.
Oh.
And that model continues to this day. Mm-hmm. It's still the prevalent hospice model. And that model was predicated on certain socioeconomic assumptions. Number one, there would be a home
uh-huh.
for someone to die in. Number two, there would be adequate support for that person in the home, i.e. a family.
Mm-hmm.
Because the hospice comes into the home to support the family in supporting the person at the end of their lives. So where those things don't happen, either there isn't a home or there isn't a family to support the person in the home, or the adequacy of the support isn't possible, that's where the niche lies for residential hospice, where people then can come into a place mm-hmm. like the Zen Hospice Guest House, where they have the support from the clinical team and the spiritual team and the volunteers that allows them, then the family, if there is family, and sometimes there isn't, but if there is family, it also allows the family at that point to step back from being the direct caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a really important moment for them as well.
But I'm seeing what you would like to see. I have a different question that kind of leads up to that. I've always been aware of the fact that birth, which is definitely a kind of a passage, we make a big festive Tehran. We pay a lot of attention to it. We see people come into this world with such exuberance and attention and care. And it has always seemed to me that we kind of need to pay the same attention to those leaving the world.
Yes, absolutely.
And not so. And that kind of gets to your people turn away.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody turns away from a birth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, births don't frighten us the way dying does.
Right.
So we each carry in ourselves this resistance and maybe even a lot of disbelief about our impermanence.
I'm so glad you said that because sometimes I've noticed when people lose a parent and sometimes the response is, was that expected? Did you expect that? Well, you have to kind of say, yes, my mother was 96.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't expect it, there's been a gap here in my awareness. But also, you know, was she sick? No. Well, what did she die of? She was 96.
Mm, yeah.
Those kind of questions. And even if you expect it, even if somebody has been sick for ages and in torment and there is no way to stay in this world among the living, that last breath is still a shock.
It is. It is. It is because...
there is no preparation for that last breath.
Yeah. It's always a shock to us.
Isn't it?
When it ends.
Why do you think?
Because we're so deeply connected to being alive.
I guess.
And you know, one of the things I've learned working with people at the end of life is how wonderful, what a gift it is
Life is?
To be alive.
Oh, yes.
It is sheer gift. And so working with people at the end of life has taught me to deeply appreciate being alive.
Oh,
I used to think that working with people at the end of life would make me less afraid of dying. It's actually made me much more respectful of the process of dying. Not less afraid, just more respectful.
I can understand that. That's what it calls for, yes.
Deeply, it's much deepened my sense of appreciation for the gift of being alive.
How nice. Yes.
And that actually is the gift that focusing on our impermanence gives to us when we are living with the awareness that we are impermanent. The paradox, this is the paradox of attending to impermanence and death,
mm-hmm.
is that the paradox is we become more alive.
Sure.
We become more aware of the gift of being alive. And that's one of the ways in which the work of hospice spills over into a much broader appreciation of our shared humanness.
What do you think it is your residents want, excuse me, most of all, at that stage in life?
Well, it's pretty diverse.
Mm-hmm.
It depends a lot on what kind of relationships they bring in
mm-hmm.
To the end of life. So if somebody has come to the end of life with some fairly strong and healthy familial relationships, then what they want most is to take care of and be cared for by those people they love most. And if they've come to the end of life without a lot of family support, then what they're looking for is to connect with someone in a way that can bring closure to their life. They want often to tell the stories of their lives.
Oh, yes.
Really important.
Hence the love letters.
Hence the love letters. Hence
the sense. People should be writing, yes.
People talking about what they loved about life,
yes.
What happened to them. Sometimes it's conversations, and I've had many conversations like this with people at the end of their lives in the last weeks and months, where they want to talk about what didn't work for them.
Oh.
The great pain of their
mm-hmm.
life. I remember once working with a woman in the last eight months of her life, in which we kept circling around the same story over and over and over again that had happened 50 years earlier. And it was about this pivotal moment in her life where she made a choice that at that point she couldn't see all the implications of.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, about a month before her death, I was sitting with her and she looked at me with tears in her eyes. And she just said, "Why did I do that?"
Oh, what's the answer to that?
And there was no answer.
Okay.
Except
yes.
to be present with
oh,
that,
yes.
right?
Yes.
What? But this was what she wanted
yes.
to work on.
Yeah.
She needed someone to help her work through to that point where she could ask herself that question and truly express how deeply she regretted some of the decisions she had made. So that also is a part of healing at the end of life, working through those
mm-hmm.
things. Some of the things are happy, some of the things are sad. But having your story heard by another person is incredibly powerful.
Well, I agree. I mean, that's the whole focus of love letters.
Exactly.
Having your story heard. And knowing that someone has paid attention, that's a gift. But do you see death as a really, when you get right down to it, it's a private moment?
Yes, it is a private moment, a profoundly private moment.
Where you are alone.
You are and you're not alone.
Okay.
So you are alone in the sense that even in this moment, as I draw breath, as you draw breath, that nobody can breathe for you and nobody
right.
can breathe for me. And yet, we're not alone. Here we are. We're having this conversation. And the same thing can happen for people at the very end of life where there is a sense of being connected right to the last breath.
Oh, to the last breath. But that last step you have to take on your own.
On your own.
Yes.
You do. Yeah. The last step is on your own, into the mystery.
You know, I've seen people do what others have called chosen their own time to die
mm-hmm.
within limits.
Mm-hmm.
I had an aunt who was dying, and everybody was around so she could say goodbye. She wanted to, and everybody wanted to. And we lived out of town, and we got there on the late side. And the nurses kept saying, I suppose we're going to, you know, she can't, she won't be here another 10 minutes. She can't be. And yet, she seemed to have hung on until we got there. And by turns, my daughters and I went and we took her hand and gave her a kiss, told her that we were there. And she barely perceptible, I wouldn't even call it a nod, but she squeezed my hand. And after we had said our goodbyes, she left.
Yeah.
And people were saying she was waiting for you to get here. What do you think of that power that people have to...
I've seen that happen over and over again.
Really?
Yeah, over and over again. There is...
I've heard about that.
Yeah, there can be a way in which it's... I don't know that I would use the word volitional, but there's a mystery that's unfolding often for people, right, in those last days and hours of life. Often people appear to be unconscious or they appear to have gone away. My own experience of being with people is that they've entered a very deep place. And in some instances, it's almost like a deep meditative state.
Well, that's the private part I was
referring
to.
And they are working there. They're working there. They're working really hard in that space, right, to move where they need to move. And so it's not that nothing's happening. Something profound is happening.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm going to be in full tears in a minute because that, yes, that's a wonderful concept and it answers so much.
Yeah.
That's not blank space. That
it's not
they're
blank
working
space.
Hard because crossing some passage has to be hard work.
It is. Yeah. And so there's this profound, mysterious work that they're doing. And I've seen it over and over again where people will be present in that profound, deep state where they're not communicating verbally anymore. Their eyes are often closed. Their breathing often changes.
Oh, I was going to ask about that. Yeah. So do they exhibit other signs of like deep coma where the nurses might say they're not going to be here another 10 minutes?
Right. So notice the breathing will change. Heart rate will change. It appears often that there's a point at which there is a choice, not a choice that's obvious to us, that's being made.
As part of the work they're doing?
Part of the work that they're, this deep work that they're doing. And it can be, for some people, waiting for somebody, as you had the experience. It can also be, in other instances, I've seen this, waiting for someone to leave.
Oh, my goodness. Never thought of that.
To leave the room.
Why?
Don't understand that completely.
And what gives you that feeling? What have you seen?
Well, for instance, I've seen a family gathered around a bed of someone who is imminently dying.
Mm-hmm.
And the family will say, well, let's just go down and get a cup of tea and we'll be right back.
Oh, and that's when
they step out of the room. And as soon as they leave, the person dies.
Oh.
Takes their last breath. So I've seen that it happen both ways.
And that's when the family say, oh, we shouldn't have left.
Exactly.
But maybe they should have.
And that's when I will say often to that family, no, you did exactly the right thing. You gave them the space that they needed to go. Yeah.
My goodness. So much to think about, really.
Yeah.
What is it you do? I didn't ask you that. What is it you actually do with the residents?
Well, at Zen Hospice, at this point, my work with the residents is mostly on a supportive basis.
Mm-hmm.
So I build relationships on an ongoing basis with residents at the guest house.
Oh, so that's what I wondered. So you're actually involved with the people. It's not like you're an administrative...
Well, no, I do administrative work.
You do?
I help raise money, actually, for Zen Hospice Project. But part of being connected for me is very important to stay connected to the people that we're actually serving.
Okay, sure,
right?
Sure.
So,
and there can't be enough spaces for people who need this kind of care.
No, there isn't. There's never enough.
Right.
There's never enough space. So, and we are, Zen Hospice Project, is always creating and working to create collaborations with others in this space.
I
in
see.
Order to both help others, we have a whole training that we do for people around care at the end of life.
Yes. Oh.
And which is really an important part of our mission.
Do you write love letters? Do you write letters? You personally?
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't. personally write letters. We have volunteers who work with residents who have been trained to help them write letters.
Okay.
And we also have something we call our storytelling program, mm-hmm. which is not so different from what we're doing now, where we actually record stories.
I know, but I want to say something about recorded stories. Lovely. But that technology changes.
Yes.
Too frequently, and what you recorded 10 years ago, you don't have today.
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
can, you just don't. And pen and paper is still the most effective information storage that we have.
Yeah, I agree.
I see letters from 100 years ago that look, but more than that, you know, once somebody's gone, I don't know if you've seen this, I certainly have in what I do. Once someone is gone and they find a letter in that person's handwriting, there's a joy. Have you found that in your own
yeah.
life? Ever found letters from yeah. your parents or people?
Uh-huh. Letters or even cards.
Yes, anything with handwriting is king.
Yes.
And also, you know, you pass down something. You're maybe close to your last breath, but you have left something that has felt the touch of your hand.
Yeah.
And when your great-grandchildren find that, they will be touching something that has felt the touch of your hand. And by the way, I want to say that even if people don't have the strength to write themselves, and somebody is doing the writing for them, that I'm guessing happens there, they can do something. They can
yes.
do something in their own, even if it's a scrawl, so that people know.
Yeah, we have a resident at the guest house now who's busy taking photographs and also writing notes that he puts on the wall.
Wonderful.
Right. Yeah.
Because sometimes that's the visible part that we live, that we leave behind us.
Yes.
And I see time and again, it's just critical. There was a man named Shaw, his last name, and he wrote an article many, many years ago in a magazine, and it was beautiful, and he said, "We have the love, but I don't have the letters.
Ah,
she's gone. I have
yeah.
nothing in her handwriting after 50 years.
Yeah.
My niece wanted my mother's date book, or her dress book.
Yeah.
Can I have it? It's got her handwriting.
Yeah.
King. So if you had to write a letter right now to someone, who would it be to?
Oh, great question. If I had to, well, almost the first person would always be my wife.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
okay.
It would always be my wife.
Does she have any? Oh, she has cards, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And what about, you know, people sometimes say to me in workshops or whatever setting, can I write a letter to someone who's not here anymore?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Oh,
and
yes.
My feeling is, yes, just because someone's died is no reason you have to stop talking to them.
Right. And it's as important what you want, what you need to say is what really matters often in those settings. There's something that wants to be said that wasn't able to be said. And there's something about my sense of wholeness that needs me to say that
mm-hmm.
in the universe.
And there's something about the receiving also.
Yes.
You know, I talked to a woman once who didn't have such an easy relationship with her father. And as he was dying, he was not even able to speak, but he mouthed, "I love you." And if that didn't carry her through the rest of her, she never really knew he did.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know what they say, that's one of the important, what we say is one of the important things that happen. There's like three or four things that can happen at the end of life. And there, it's different, people talk about it in different ways, but you know, it's like the four sayings at the end of life, right? So it is, I love you is an important one. You know, I forgive you. Please forgive me. Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And goodbye.
Yes.
Right. So, but being able to feel that you have been loved
mm-hmm.
and express love is at the very essence of what it means to be alive at the end of life.
And how nice to have that in writing in addition if people can do that.
Yeah.
Yes. I think, and you know, there are ways of saying things. There are endless ways of saying things. I want to say thank you for doing this with me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
It's been such a joy.
Let's give, well, if we Google Zen Hospice Center.
If you Google Zen Hospice Project and you'll find
Project.
This.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's important to know that. And if people who want to contribute and.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
you can
you're
go
there
to
with
our
the
website,
mitt,
and there
right?
I am. I'm just send it in.
Good. Okay. Oh, thank you again. I'm so happy we met.
Me too.
And until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye. And please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion, and how nice to be able to write those love letters to people who are dying. I have wonderful stories about people who have received letters maybe a day before their death, but their enjoyment and their glee over it is not diminished because they're not going to be here the next day. So just if you have a good thought about somebody, put it in an envelope and mail it, and gratitude taken to the grave serves no one, may I just say. Okay, goodbye, everybody. Talk to you later.